Welcome to episode 11 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. This is Lawyers Talking About Technology, Security, Privacy, and Government. And because it's another Monday, there's another 6 inches of snow on the ground. Our offices are depopulated, and many people are calling in for this. Despite that, I'm looking forward to an excellent program because we've got two people I've been hoping to get on the program for a while. Markham Erickson, who played an integral role in writing and negotiating many of the federal laws that govern e-commerce and technology in the use of the Internet in Washington, has joined us as a partner in our Washington office and is on the podcast to talk about some of these topics. Michael Vadas, a regular formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department and now in our New York office, will be contributing. And then I'm pleased to say he'll be conducting an interview with Dan Novak. Dan Novak is the legal analyst for The Intercept, which is part of the emerging publishing empire of Glenn Greenwald and Pierre Omidyar, First Look. So we'll be hearing from Dan and Michael a little later in the program. And then finally, Daniela Taruso, who's a policy advisor in Steptoe's Brussels office, and she focuses primarily on changes to EU legislation and particularly the proposed data protection bill. I am Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS. Why don't we get started? The first set of questions that I wanted to talk about is, of course, this week in NSA. The EFF went back and forth on the question of what to do about the privacy protections in NSA's metadata program. There had been a 5-year data retention limit on that program, and then the EFF wrote in and said, hang on a minute, we'd like you to keep that data for longer than 5 years because it might turn out to be valuable evidence. I actually made fun of EFF recently, saying, I don't quite understand this. You're challenging this whole program because the only protections are protections that are provided by court order. Now you're telling us you want to get rid of the 5-year retention limit and keep the data longer, but nobody should worry because the access to that data is controlled by a court order. I'm not sure that that made as much sense as it seemed to when the EFF started down this road. The other couple of issues that arose up in connection with NSA, the New York Times had this article that, frankly, I found a little odd. The raw take discussion. Charlie Savage, smart guy, good reporter, has this long article about the raw take orders that the New York Times talked about. Essentially, if I understand it, what the New York Times was saying is that in about 2002, the government decided to allow greater access to what's called the raw take, or the broad, unfiltered amount of information that was collected by NSA, and that's now available information is now being made available to CIA and NCTC and other agencies. I'm not sure why that's so surprising. That's kind of the result of the 9/11 Commission report and the decision to share data. So I was never quite sure why the New York Times wrote the article or what the point of it was. Michael, any idea what was going on in that article?
No, I don't know. Understand what the objective was, but I think anything that they can get their hands on, they're going to publish a story about it because, you know, even more than us, they like to have this week in NSA, and this just suits that strategy, I think, long term.
Yeah. And so the ABA has now had an exchange of letters with the National Security Agency. The ABA said, hey, we don't like it when people read privileged emails. And the director of NSA said, don't worry, we're really careful about not interfering with the privileged communications. I'm not sure. Everybody seemed much happier after that exchange, even though I'm not sure that it really either side said anything that hadn't been said before.
You know, on that, I found the whole thing a little perplexing because there's almost an unstated presumption that there's some law prohibiting intrusion into attorney-client communications. And, of course, the privilege is just an evidentiary construct. It's not based on statutory law, at least as far as I know. And so there's nothing specific in law prohibiting the NSA from gathering intelligence from those communications. And indeed, it doesn't refrain from them. It does set internal strictures beyond what's required by law. And I was actually surprised by the NSA's response because I went into it thinking, okay, here's going to be another complete snow job where NSA doesn't actually say anything substantive. So I went into it skeptical, and as I went on, I was actually surprised by the amount of substance in it. And I think it should give some comfort to those who do have, I think, perhaps too broad a view of the privilege.
Yeah, it's
kind of it's a puzzling area in that there's the attorney-client privilege that is in place that we rely on in today's electronic ecosystem. There are many attorneys that communicate with their lawyers over systems where the technology provider, in their terms of service, state that they may be periodically reviewing or scanning those communications and that they may be doing that on a routine basis. So I'm not sure in some ways that what this involves is anything different than how disclosures are made in other electronic communications.
Yeah, you're right. It is a little hard to say. I was I expected confidentiality if you're using Hotmail or Yahoo Mail or Gmail.
Yeah.
All right. Well, NSA, the question of what's going to happen with the metadata program is still in flux, but Dutch Ruppersberger, who's the ranking minority member of the House Intelligence Committee, has suggested that maybe there's a different approach that ought to be taken rather than continuing to insist on storing all of this data in one place. Ruppersberger's proposal is to go back to the situation, really largely the situation that existed prior to creation of this database. The proposal is that the telcos just hold on to this data for as long as they would be expected to hold on to it, and NSA and the FBI will come in with national security letters or some other form of subpoena and ask for the information. I'm not sure that works very well, and this may be a kind of slow motion surrender by the agency, and as some of its defenders start looking for a new approach. That's how I read it. I couldn't see a way in which you could make that multi-hop analysis work using national security letters or subpoenas. And last but not least, I just got back from a debate over whether Edward Snowden is a hero or a traitor. I wasn't really enthusiastic about arguing that he was a traitor, so I argued that he just was not a patriot. I got two good things out of that. One, we actually had a vote both before and after the argument. The original vote on the UCLA campus was 43 said he was a patriot and 33 said he was either a traitor or he was not a patriot. After our argument, 51 people said he was not a patriot and only 34 said he was. So I felt we did pretty well in debunking Edward Snowden, and that's kind of consistent with what I've started to see when I've started to ask people for a show of hands, Edward Snowden, good or bad, and audiences are breaking 2 and 3 and 4 to 1 against Snowden. It's kind of an interesting development. But
these aren't your friends at the Federalist Society, I take it? These are more general.
Well, look, my friends at the Federalist Society would have me hanged and quartered. They're all big Rand Paul fans. No, this one was the UCLA campus, and you know, it was the law school campus, but still, it was just a bunch of academics. And then the other audience I asked recently was the Minority Corporate Counsel Association and a bunch of lawyers working on their corporate counsel issues. But when we asked for a show of hands, Snowden came in distinctly second. The other thing that's good that I got out of this is because the sides were chosen and you had to be either arguing for Patriot or traitor, I now have a cool little sign that goes on my desk that says Stuart Baker traitor. so they'll save money when they do the show trials later on.
I wonder if one thing that accounts for those numbers is not just your incredible persuasiveness, but also the fact that the Snowden leaks have gone way beyond information about surveillance practices within the United States, and now we're seeing article after article, including by The Intercept, which you know we'll talk with Dan a little bit about later. That talk about our sources and methods with regard to collection overseas against our adversaries and potential adversaries. And it may be that a lot more people in the general public say, hey, wait a second, I was fine with revelations about the metadata program and the 702 program and things like that. But I'm not comfortable having the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians and the North Koreans know exactly how we go about collecting SIGINT on their systems. And so that may have cause some people at least to reconsider their initial positive views about Snowden.
You know, Michael, that's such a good point, because I think that a lot of the press stories that we see circulated really conflate the two issues about disclosures relative to domestic surveillance and disclosures relative to foreign surveillance, which are two totally different things. And I think that those two dynamics get conflated too often in the press stories. And by law and by policy, we ought to have different policies that apply to foreign surveillance relative to domestic surveillance, right?
That's always been the position. That it doesn't sell so well in Europe when you put it that way. But I do agree that we ought to be looking at those as two separate things. And in fact, when I did the argument, I spent most of my time explaining that there'd been massive disclosures that hadn't started any serious debates in the United States, and I thought that probably helped account for the change of view that many people had. All right. Well, actually, this wasn't the week for NSA principally. In fact, many people at NSA were saying, "Phew, we dodged a bullet." Instead, the Senate Intelligence Committee has been fighting with the CIA, a brutal knockdown, dragout, Dianne Feinstein versus John Brennan fight. Michael, did you follow that? There's some interesting arguments. Dianne Feinstein on the floor of the Senate saying that she thought that her committee's files had been hacked, and that the CIA was guilty of violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and that they were, what was it, engaged in a, I can't remember, it was a kind of attack on the committee, and I wondered whether you had followed either of those.
Yeah, I followed it closely because I find it really interesting. Dianne Feinstein, one of the staunchest defenders of the intelligence community, in the Senate, and on the Senate Intelligence Committee, gave a blistering speech on the Senate floor because she essentially claims that the CIA is trying to undermine the committee's investigation into the CIA's interrogation program. They've been going about this for years now. They've got a draft report, which I believe is still in the declassification review process. But one of the things that's really sensitive is that there is this apparently an internal CIA report called the, I think it's called the Panetta Report, because it was done under the direction of a former CIA director, Leon Panetta, which, according to Feinstein, actually corroborates some of the conclusions that the Senate Intelligence Committee report makes about violations of law, violations of policy, and things like that. In the process of doing this review, the CIA was not willing to give a lot of documents over to the committee for them to take back to Capitol Hill to do their review. Instead, they insisted that they do all their review of the documents at a CIA location, essentially, on CIA computers, but the computers would be firewalled off from the rest of the CIA network and accessible only to CIA IT people to keep the system up and running. And they were apparently, or supposedly, I'm not sure which, forbidden from telling the CIA anything about what those IT people learned on the network. Well, according to Feinstein, the CIA gave, you know, thousands and thousands of documents to the committee staff for review, but then a lot of those documents started disappearing, including draft versions of the Panetta report. And Feinstein alleges that essentially the CIA hacked into the network, its own network, but the part of the network that was meant just for the CISI staff, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And she, you know, she claims basically that this is a violation of separation of powers because a part of the executive branch is not allowing the legislative branch to engage in its oversight function. I actually think that's, you know, if her factual allegations are correct, I think she's got a lot of merit there. She also claims that there was a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act because under the agreement reached between the committee and the agency wasn't supposed to access the committee's portion of the network. I think that's a, that's probably not much of an argument since the CIA does own the network, and the fact that the CIA may have agreed to limit its own access to its own network, I think even people who construed the CFAA broadly wouldn't think there was much merit, at least nothing that a prosecutor would take up. Yet the CIA made a crimes report to the Justice Department to review this. At the same time, the Senate Intelligence Committee made a crimes report to the Justice Department. So both sides are accusing the other of CFAA violations, among other things.
What's next? Do they do a crimes report on each other's mothers too?
You know, the criminal allegations, I think, are probably not going to go anywhere unless there's more to this than what we know now. But I do think there's a very serious issue here about interfering with congressional oversight functions. I mean, the CIA has made it very difficult for the committee to get access to documents that they need to investigate an extremely controversial subject matter. And, you know, the president said upon taking office that he wanted to put all that stuff behind him. But, you know, there are many people who I think legitimately believe that you can't just put something behind us without actually knowing what happened. And so to the extent Congress is interfering with that, I think Feinstein's got a valid point.
She seemed very, very upset about the filing of a crimes report. That seemed to really bother Dianne Feinstein. And yet my sense is the intelligence community is expected to file a crimes report at the drop of a hat. If there's anything even remotely criminal in the neighborhood, the CIA and NSA are not supposed to make their own determinations about whether it's really a crime or not. They're just supposed to hand it off to the Justice Department. And so, you know, I sent over crimes reports all the time never expected to see them turn into prosecutions, and they never did. I wonder if Dianne Feinstein is just surprised to find herself on the receiving end of something that happens all the time in the intelligence community.
Yeah, that could be. And I think, you know, on her end, I think to the extent there was a report filed about the CIA's own actions, I think that might have been based in part on the CIA IG's investigation, because, you know, there hasn't been any specific in the papers, but there was an allusion to the IG's finding something amiss with how the CIA handled this matter. But it is, you know, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the AG's conference room to figure out exactly how they're going to, or to hear how they're going to try to resolve these conflicting allegations.
Well, sure, the fact that Michael, that you, the point you made, which is so true, Dianne Feinstein is known for being a defender of the intelligence community and has always defended the CIA in political circles, and her actions here demonstrate that the CIA at least has a serious problem with regard to their oversight committees if Dianne Feinstein is making these kind of accusations.
Yes, this is the personal relationship. She has very strong personal views, she's going to bring them to bear, and they're not going to be favorable to the CIA, I'm pretty sure. So it will be awkward for the CIA for quite a while, and NSA might get a longer break than otherwise they would be expecting. Let's talk about commerce, and the Commerce Department and ICANN. The Commerce Department announced that it was getting ready to give up its role overseeing ICANN. I don't know how fast they're planning to do it, or how seriously, how big a change this really is going to mean. Markham, have you followed this? It's getting lots of press as, you know, the U.S. wounded by NSA disclosures is bailing out and leaving ICANN to the Russians. I'm not sure it's quite that bad, but what actually is happening here?
Well, only slightly less controversial than Edward Snowden, NSA, and CIA is ICANN, the International Cooperation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which is the organization that is responsible for administering the technical functions of the internet. So what the U.S. Commerce Department's National Telecommunications and Information Administration Group, the NTIA, announced is its intention to transition key internet domain name functions to ICANN. The current contract with ICANN and NTIA isn't scheduled to expire until 2015. So one thing that's important to note, despite the excitement in the press on many sides over the announcement, is that today nothing is changing. And what what NTIA has said is that they intend to relinquish their oversight of DNS and the IANA functions, but they first want ICANN to demonstrate a couple of key issues. Now, what are DNS and IANA functions? DNS is the domain name system, which is essentially the phone book for the internet. It allows users to identify websites, mail servers, and other IP addresses with easy-to-understand names like www.ntia.gov rather than their numeric addresses. The IANA functions are the technical functions that enable the continued efficient operation of the internet. Today, the NTIA has oversight of those things, but from a day-to-day practical standpoint, they don't perform any operational role. They have given ICANN for years now a lot of the day-to-day operational control over this, and they also have a contract with VeriSign to allow VeriSign to handle a lot of the IANA functions, the root zone file management issues, and other things. So NTIA has an oversight role. They control this through their contract, but they don't provide a day-to-day role anymore. So nothing's happening in the short term. And in the long term, what ICANN is going to have to demonstrate in order for the NTIA to give up its role over these functions are four things. They've said that ICANN is going to have to show that they can support and enhance the multi-stakeholder model that currently governs the internet. They can maintain the security, stability, and resiliency of the internet domain name system. They can meet the needs and expectation of the global customers and partners of the IANA services And finally, that they can demonstrate they can maintain the openness of the Internet. So the ball is now in ICANN's court to begin doing that, and ICANN sent out a subsequent press release noting that it will begin that process immediately to satisfy those four things. This has been in the works for a while. The Commerce Department in 1998 indicated that its policy was that eventually it relinquish and transition its role to the private sector. And so last week's announcement was the culmination of this. We've seen some statements of opposition to this and some statements of support, but there's still a while to go before we see if this if there comes to final fruition here.
So there may or may not be another contract in 2015.
Yeah, they haven't decided that. They put the ball in ICANN's court to demonstrate that ICANN has the ability to do that and assume the role, but they haven't said that they're definitely giving up the role. They said they plan to.
Yeah, I it seems to me that this is the role that the U.S. government plays in the functioning of ICANN is it's like your dad's hand on the back of the bicycle as you're trying to learn. You don't even know whether it's there or not, and you ought to be able to ride by yourself. And more or less, ICANN has been doing that without a lot of interference from the U.S. government. And I suppose the worry here is that either they'll ride off on their own and go off in a direction that nobody likes, or that it'll turn out to be Vladimir Putin's hand back there, and he'll give the whole thing a good hard shove. Both of those, I suppose, are possible.
Well, there's a lot of mystery with regard to ICANN. I mean, it is a unwieldy organization by its very nature, with a lot of different stakeholders. Very difficult to truly penetrate and to get it moving quickly, but that's sort of the nature of the Internet. And for all the complaints about ICANN, no one's really come up with a better model for how a global Internet can be governed in a multi-stakeholder way. And it's certainly better than the alternative of that some would say that all of this should be moved to the UN, where governments each have one vote in how the Internet works, and that this ought to be a government-controlled communications platform. I think there's widespread agreement that that would be disastrous. So while ICANN certainly has its issues, it's better than that alternative. And I think the perception that the U.S. is willing to relinquish its contract and its oversight role certainly helps those that have complained that the U.S. is too heavy-handed with regard to the functioning of the Internet. It really helps to alleviate those concerns, and hopefully will help with countries like Brazil and some in Russia and others that have complained that the U.S. plays too much of a role.
Yeah, and it's true, I think, that the Snowden leaks have hurt the U.S.'s ability to hang on to this sort of stick-in-the-closet authority. So one more contribution to human rights from Edward Snowden. Let's turn to another sort of international fallout from the Snowden revelations, which is that the European Parliament actually did something, too late to actually accomplish anything, but in plenty of time to stir up controversy. Daniela Taruso's calling in from our Brussels office, and she's been following all of this. Daniela, what's the Parliament did? What has the Parliament done, and why'd they do it now?
Okay. Well, the European Parliament did two things this week. The first is that they adopted two proposals. They adopted their part of two proposals. The first is the regulation to reform the EU framework for privacy policy in the EU. And the second is the directive which will reform the framework for police and judicial cooperation. So those two pieces of legislation are being revised right now between the European Commission, the European Parliament, and the Council. And the European Parliament had to take it as far as they could before they have the European elections at the end of May. This is what they duly did this week. And they also passed a non-binding resolution following what has been an investigation following the Edward Snowden revelations into mass surveillance, where they called for a whole range of actions to be taken by the European Commission and the Council, including suspension of the Safe Harbour Agreement, which is the legal agreement which underpins commercial data transfers between the EU and the US. And they called for a number of other things which we can talk about as well, if you like. But that side was largely non-binding. The more interesting thing for, I think, our listeners and companies who maybe are on the podcast today is that the parliamentarians had to basically take their part of the negotiation as far as they could before we break, as I say, for European elections. And for those who are not really familiar with the European negotiating process, what happens is the European Parliament puts down its position. Well, the European Commission, first of all, puts down its position, a proposal. The European Parliament puts down its position, and then the Council, which is the 28 member states, the governments, put down their position. So we needed the sequence to occur, and the European Parliament did its part this week. And I think the interesting thing is that they did a number of things. They proposed a number of things which the US organizations, US companies would find troubling. They increased the potential for fines for firms that would be in breach of the regulations.
Something like 5% of your annual revenue or something, wasn't it?
It would be they would like firms who are caught in breach to be fined up to 100 million euro or 5% of global turnover.
Whichever is larger or whichever is less.
Yeah. I mean, basically they want if you like antitrust style sanctioning, because they believe that this kind of breach is the only way that that firms will take this kind of legislation seriously. The European Commission had already proposed, I think it was 2%. The European Parliament said that's not enough. Of course, you know, the third institution, the European the Council of Ministers, to agree before this actually became law. So, you know, we're still waiting to hear from them. We will have to see what they have to say. But of course, in a negotiating position, you know, the European Parliament has put it up.
Right. Either of those is such an astonishing, largely large number that it will change the dynamic. The other thing that they did that I found kind of astonishing is they said, if the data comes from Europe, you're storing it in another country, let's say the United States, you can't give it to the government of the country where it's being stored without the permission of European authorities. Is that right?
Well, they did tinker with the article that dealt with this issue. The European Commission had already proposed some language which had talked about this issue that we have, of course, where companies are then, you know, transferring data across, but then they are in the grip of a subpoena or whatever. And the European Parliament, of course, have been caught with this timing in the midst of the Snowden revelations and felt that they needed to take action and felt they needed to ramp up the aspects of this article. And so, you know, wanted to basically, as you say, forbid companies from being able to provide information. So, you know, organizations would be caught between the devil and the deep blue sea with the legislation because, you know, on one hand, they'd be forbidden from EU law, but on a US law perspective, they would be also caught because, you know, they would have to give it under US law provisions.
Yeah.
So I'm really not sure how we would reconcile the conflict of laws in this situation. I mean, of course, we're in the middle of a negotiation, so, you know, obviously we're not at the end yet where we've got a published piece of law where you know, we'd have to take it to litigation. So, I mean, it's really going to be for the three EU institutions to get behind the closed doors in the trilogue and to try to work out some language that actually works and is actually possible for companies to comply with. Unfortunately, it's for the companies as well to help, and part of their role, I think, is actually to demonstrate where the sticking points are.
I have to say, I think it's absolutely nuts, and the Commission is almost certainly in violation of international law, or the Parliament in proposing to try to regulate how data is handled in other countries. They've spent 30 or 40 years saying because we can't regulate the way law applies to our data once it's exported, we have to restrict its export. And now they've turned around and said, oh, by the way, we're going to regulate how data is handled after it's exported, and we're going to interfere with the most basic security rights of other countries within their country. I think if we told the French that they couldn't look at data that came from the United States without our permission, they would tell us where to put it. I'm surprised that the European Parliament thinks it can get away with this.
I think, I mean, the main point is that you know, before anything actually is adopted for real, it has to go through a rigorous sort of screening test with the lawyer linguists, and I really think that the bugs will have to come out then.
But at the moment we're in a very
political phase where we're just literally a few weeks away from the European election, and I do hope that things calm down after that.
So the way this works is the legislation has to go through several readings, and there's no time to go through all those readings before the election. So as a kind of way to stake out their ground, this Parliament has passed a bill that will only become law if it's adopted by, what did Sophie Intveld say, by the Euroskeptics, the racists, and the homophobes who will be elected after us. So this issue is actually going to get taken up next year. Is that right?
The official timetable is to aim for the end of the year.
You don't have to call them racists or homophobes. Don't worry.
I think that's rather optimistic. I don't share Sophie Intervall's view on her future colleagues in the European Parliament. Actually, we're probably going to end up with quite a similar balance of powers in the Parliament after the election. I do hope we end up with a reasonably large centre-right, reasonably large centre-left grouping, and perhaps one or two more of the extremists, but not too many, that mean that we can't adopt any useful legislation. I mean, we need, a decent bunch of 500, 600 or so MEPs that can actually do some work. And then we will have, the fringe element that exists in every parliament that's known to man. The loonies that can be described however you wish. But I do hope we end up, in June with a bunch of MEPs we can work with.
But you are expecting that the why is Sophie so sure that there are going to be a wave of racists and homophobes? Is she under some pressure in the Netherlands? Is there going to be a big change there?
She's got Herta Wilders in her neck of the woods. She's got some very extreme people standing close to her. We've got the National Front in France. We've got the UK Independence Party in the UK. We're going to get some strange characters coming across. People who don't want very much to do with Europe, who just want to be there to wreck it, who won't be very constructive at all. But, you know, we managed to manage that element of the parliament this time round, in that we were able, as in Brussels in general, not, you know, Steptoe, but the Brussels was able to work around those elements and work with the people who wanted to actually create something and have a European Union that works.
She did call them Eurosceptics, racists, and homophobes, but said, the one thing I agree with them on is we all hate the United States, or words to that effect. Probably not quite that bad.
Famous for using colorful language.
All right, well, let's see if we can move on, because it sounds like watching paint dry would be about as productive as waiting for the European Parliament to actually pass legislation, and we'll all have to wait for the elections to find out exactly what the next parliament
commission
is going to
do. We should say. We're going to get a new commission as well. Huh?
That's right. That's right. And my favorite politician, Vivian Redding, who invented the right to be forgotten and some of the dumber provisions in the European Commission's draft, is not going to be coming back in the Commission. Is that right?
No. She will not be coming back in the next Commission.
All right. Well, that's okay, although I'm sure she'll pop up in the European Parliament. We'll get to be entertained by her there. Let's turn to another development, the hacker breach case. I always thought that establishing that people had been negligent in a hacker breach case was going to be pretty straightforward. But this Silverpop case, Michael, makes it sound like it might be harder than the plaintiff's bar has thought to establish negligence.
Possibly, yeah. I think in some respects it does. In other respects, it might not. This was a case brought by Leading Market Technologies against Silverpop. Leading Market Technologies was marketing its products through Silverpop, which does internet marketing, and had uploaded the email of about 500,000 of its customers. In November 2010, Silverpop experienced a network breach, and someone gained access to all of that Leading Market Technology email. So LMT sued, alleging negligence and also breach of contract. And recently, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois granted Silverpop's motion to dismiss, holding that it was not negligent, or at least there had been insufficient proof that they were negligent, because Leading Market Technologies had not proven that there was an established standard of care for how you're supposed to safeguard information. And to prevail on a negligence claim, you've got to show that there was a violation of some standard of care. That, to me, was the strange part of the decision, and maybe it was just a matter of inadequate lawyering. I hate to cast aspersions, but, you know, given the case law out there, the 50-some-odd FTC settlements in which the FTC has said what sorts of security practices are inadequate, the recently issued cybersecurity framework from the Obama administration, you know, there are a lot of things that a plaintiff's lawyer could point to as establishing the standard of care. And so, you know, I haven't looked at the complaint here, but that may just have been a shortcoming on the part of the plaintiffs.
It may just be that the judge didn't think much of the party who brought the claim, and that maybe he was just trying to get out of a contract. There was something funny going on here. I think that the judge was pretty unsympathetic to the plaintiff.
Yeah, the more significant part of it was that the judge ruled in the alternative that LMT's claim was barred by the so-called economic loss doctrine. And this is a doctrine that exists in tort law in a lot of states, and it basically holds that if your only loss is economic rather than some physical harm to person or property, then you can't bring a negligence claim unless there was some sort of special relationship between the parties. And Georgia apparently applies the economic loss doctrine, so that was an independent reason that the claim couldn't proceed. And I think that's very significant, because for those states that have that doctrine, it's going to be very difficult for plaintiffs to succeed on negligence claims. The other claim LMT brought was a contract claim, saying that basically the contract between the parties provided for the safe storage of LMT's email lists. And the judge said, no, the contract was strictly for provision of email marketing services and did not encompass safe storage of information. I think the lesson there is just that if you're storing your information with a cloud provider, make sure that the contract provides that they will store your information securely and have as much specificity there as possible, so that if that the provider is breached, you've got at least a potential breach of contract claim.
Well, that's good advice. Almost anybody, anyone you sign up a contract with, including your HVAC supplier, you ought to get an assurance that he's going to handle his interactions with you securely. Which was, of course, a reference to the Target case. This week in Target continues, even though Jason Weinstein isn't with us this week, because it turns out from some of the reporting that Target did miss an opportunity to stop the exploit. They had a FireEye system that did identify the malware and send an alert, and the company didn't act on it. I think the company's explanation is pretty much along the lines of, we got hundreds of those a week, we couldn't respond to them all, a sort of information overload argument. But it was still, I'm sure that'll become a big part of the litigation. What I thought was interesting is that if you looked a little more closely at what happened, it's an argument against the Justice Department's current interpretation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It turns out that this malware collects the data and actually exfiltrates it automatically by logging into a command and control server using username and password to get onto the crook's command and control network and to deposit the stolen card numbers, where they sit for maybe a day until the crook comes along and says, do you have any mail for me? And look, sees some mail and downloads the cards, which means that if Target had really been following this, they could have looked at the software, which had the username and password built into it. They could have extracted the username and password. They could have logged onto the computer where their data was stored and taken it back, except that the Justice Department position apparently is, I'm sorry, that's a felony because it's not your computer. That's crazy in this context. If you could get your data back before it's actually been taken by the thieves, even if it means logging onto the thief's computer, it seems to me nuts for the Justice Department to be casting doubt on whether that kind of tactic is appropriate. All right, I'm not gonna tweak anybody into responding to that one. So let me ask Michael. I thought that the privacy groups have discovered a new and very clever tactic. Maybe I just hadn't seen this before, but they've filed with the FTC to block the Facebook acquisition of WhatsApp on privacy grounds, saying, you know, once you are assimilated into the Borg, the WhatsApp privacy policies will no longer be honored. It's particularly clever because the FTC has both merger review and privacy. Well, it has merger review authority and privacy regulatory aspirations. So this is opening a new way for the FTC to impose privacy rules. Is this something that's happened before?
Well, you know, I think they've learned well from the federal government's practices in the CFIUS area and the FCC, you know, where the government has imposed requirements on companies that want to acquire U.S. companies, for instance, to allow means for electronic surveillance to be built into foreign companies' networks, at least in the U.S. parts, and the FCC.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Exactly. And the FCC trying to impose net neutrality principles in acquisitions of telecom companies. So I think this is a similar thing. You know, at the very least, they'd like to have some assurances if the deal goes through that WhatsApp's existing privacy policies be preserved, and that they not start engaging in targeted advertising based on their users' communications and the metadata of their communications.
Yeah, so I'm not sure this works as well in Europe as it would in the U.S. Because the data protection authorities, thank God, don't have the ability to block mergers. But their treatment of Google, saying Google was not allowed to consolidate its privacy policies, suggests that this would get a very enthusiastic audience in Europe. Daniela, do you agree that the DPAs are probably not going to be able to block mergers?
No, they would not be able to block mergers as far as I'm concerned. No.
All right. Well, that's thank God for small favors. Let me just wrap up with three or four other developments in security. We got to see what Russia uses for cyber espionage tools. Several reports out about some very sophisticated tools that the Russians have finally gotten caught using. Google has started encrypting search, adopting SSL in China. This is not going to end well, probably for Google, is my guess. That's a very aggressive thing to do. It may not end well for SSL because it'll encourage governments to break SSL more enthusiastically. Leon Panetta trotted out Cyber Pearl Harbor. He really believes that that's a real risk, even though, you know, bien pensant circles think it's a overhyped analogy. But then we got a report saying that if there was a physical attack on a handful of electrical substations some August, we could be without power in the United States for like 18 months because we don't have enough transformers to replace the ones that would be destroyed. So almost all bad news in this week in security.
And yet not news at all. I mean, because some of this stuff, you know, many of us were saying back in the mid and late 90s. So the only news there in that little roundup is Google encrypting its search processes. The possibility for Cyber Pearl Harbor, you know, you and I and many others got ridiculed for saying anything even close to that a long time ago. The vulnerability of our electrical infrastructure to either physical or cyber attack has been something that people who worked in this field have known about for a very long time. But, you know, I think it's good that it's getting more attention now and that there are more people in senior or formerly senior officials positions are making a big deal out of this stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, that now the reaction to it is sort of more tired than frothing. People say, oh, really, you shouldn't say that. You don't know that for sure. But they're slowly being worn down by the facts. That doesn't mean we're doing more to protect ourselves, but at least the likelihood that this is a real risk is slowly building in people's minds. Well, that's the week in review, and I'm sorry it went a little long, but now we're going to turn to our interview. Michael's going to be interviewing Dan Novak. Dan had a distinguished career as a lawyer, apart from the part where he was Glenn Greenwald's associate, and then was tempted by Glenn to come over to First Look, where he works as an analyst at The Intercept. Welcome, Dan, and Michael, take it away.
Thanks, Stuart. And then you and Markham and Daniela, you know, chime in if you've got questions or want to pinpoint something that Dan says. Dan, maybe we can start by just telling us a little bit about First Look and Intercept and how they came to fruition and what the areas of focus are.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, and I congratulate you, Stuart, on what sounds like a very successful debate. I'm going to do the best I can to avoid further erosion of support for Mr. Snowden among UCLA students.
Don't talk about it, man.
That might be the best strategy. The Intercept is the first digital publication of First Look. First Look began really out of Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay's desire to have an impact in the media world. He felt that press freedoms are under sustained assault in this country, and that it was necessary to empower journalists to be adversarial and have the full support, both from the publisher himself and from the legal team and every aspect of the organization. So around the same time, Glenn Greenwald was well into his publishing at The Guardian, but was experiencing challenges, as any organization has, in getting through those material and getting it published, and was thinking about starting his own startup at the time as well. So they sort of connected at a very fortuitous moment for both of them and found a lot of common ground. So the decision was made for Glenn to jump over and build this enterprise, First Look, with Pierre. Now, First Look is going to be a lot broader than simply NSA or surveillance. It's going to be really a full-fledged news site, and it's going to also have these digital magazines, the first of which is The Intercept, where I'm at. But we also just hired Matt Taibbi, formerly of Rolling Stone. He's going to be heading up his own digital publication. So all those publications will be sort of under the same umbrella and will feed up into the larger enterprise of First Look.
So is it all funded by Omidyar, or is there going to be advertising funding? One of the new models for publishing now is to have foundations or wealthy individuals fund publications so that, you know, they can focus on investigative journalism and not have to worry about declining resources.
Exactly. I think investigative journalism is really expensive. It's often perceived as a loss leader for newspapers. And so right now, it's fully funded by Mr. Omidyar. There are plans to make it, you know, viable. I think that no one wants to create something where the only business model that can exist in our society is to have a rich philanthropist come and you know, pay out of pocket. Of course, he's made the commitment. I think he's already committed something like $250 million just as a starting point to this enterprise, which I think was roughly about the price that Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post. But of course, the plan is to build something that's viable that other people can look to as an example. So all those decisions about advertising and other revenue streams, that's all being worked out. It's not something that I'm involved in. I wouldn't have anything to contribute to that discussion anyway. So I think I'm really looking forward to finding out those answers myself. Right now, The Intercept doesn't have advertising on it. But the goal is, of course, to find ways to make this work.
So The Intercept certainly suggests, the name The Intercept suggests that your focus is going to be on surveillance practices and intelligence. Is that right, or is there going to be more to it?
So The Intercept is kind of a funny way of putting the cart before the horse, because of course we're the first magazine for a larger enterprise that has not yet launched. So the reason why The Intercept exists right now, as opposed to when First Look will launch, you know, in a more robust form, is that Glenn couldn't sit on the NSA reporting and needed a place for it to go. Now he had published at various foreign outlets and domestic as well, but you know the goal was to have it here. And because news of the First Look really leaked very quickly, it wasn't tenable for him to remain at The Guardian. So they worked really hard to build something get a site up so that we could have the infrastructure in place for the reporting to continue, because it just wouldn't be tenable to have it remain out there without a venue. So the Intercept was created first to deal with the immediate Edward Snowden reporting, but the goal is to get way broader than that. Certainly there's a lot more material to come, but that's going to be something that isn't going to be there forever. And so the Intercept is very broadly speaking, anything certainly government-oriented, oversight, surveillance, but really anything criminal justice-oriented. We have a really fabulous writer named Liliana Segura, who's focused for the last several years of The Nation on criminal justice, prisons, and war on drugs and issues like that. So it really will become far, far broader sooner than later. But, of course, the Snowden reporting is our immediate focus right now.
Right. Well, what do you think? And I know you're not personally engaged in the Snowden reporting, and you've got other areas of interest and focus now. But what's your reaction to the statement I made earlier when Stuart was talking about the debates that he's been involved in? He didn't mention one at Oxford. I think that was also very interesting. But the sense that at least that I have and others have that, you know, the leaks have gone so far beyond reporting on domestic surveillance activities, which I think a lot of Americans might have said, you know, even though I don't like the way this went about, this is something that we really should know about as a democracy or as a democratic republic. But now we're learning so much more about specific sources and methods of how NSA gathers intelligence about its adversaries and potential adversaries, you know. And I think a lot of people say, whoa, that's not something I bargained for when I started proclaiming my support for Snowden, and I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this stuff. You know, what's your take on that? Do you think that's a real trend? Is it something that you have a personal view on that you're willing to share with us?
Sure. I do have a personal view, so just speaking for myself, and first of all, I support global privacy broadly. So the goal of informing people in Europe and Asia and, you know, Latin America about how their rights are being treated by the world's greatest superpower is something that I support, and I value that. But I do think that it's necessary to look at the timeline of events, because some of the earliest revelations from Snowden after the initial reveal of PRISM and some of those domestic programs were international. And in fact, he provided information about spying on Hong Kong citizens, and was asked a similar version of the same question you asked me, which is, well, what about this foreign stuff? And he said, well, and I'm paraphrasing, but he made the point that we're engaging in so many operations overseas. The vast majority of the ones that we're looking at right now are in countries that we're not at war with, we're not even adversarial to. Europe, Latin America, you can look at the hacking of Belgicom in Belgium. You can look at the hacking of Petrobras in Brazil. And these are things that are incredibly aggressive operations that are being done in our name, you know, as citizens. And Mr. Snowden made the point that you can't really have informed consent about what, consent of the governed about these operations if we don't know what they are. So as an American, I'm really, think it's my right to know what the government's doing in my name. Now, I don't want to know how they're tracking Osama bin Laden. I don't want to know how they're looking for legitimate targets of the state. But we haven't seen that in the reporting. So I think that distinction has been muddled a bit. And I also dispute the idea
Can I just ask a question? You haven't seen that in the reporting. What about the disclosure of the fact that the U.S. is working with Norway to try to gather intelligence on what the Russians are doing in the Kona Peninsula, or that it's working with Sweden to try to gather intelligence on Russia? Those strike me as damaging stories that it's a little hard to say, oh, well, we're shocked that you're spying on people who aren't adversaries.
Sure. Well, what I look at when I see those stories is the Swedes and the Norwegians don't know that this is occurring, that their governments are doing this. And in fact, in many of these cases, the governments are breaking their own domestic law when supporting NSA activity. So these are the distinction that I'm making here is that these activities are violating law in these countries, and these countries don't even know about it. So you can look at it as what are they doing for us and what are they furthering, but it's also important to understand that that they're involved so that their activities are so closely aligned. I'm sorry?
The idea is you're an American lawyer and you're going to tell the Norwegians what their law is and what their government is allowed to do. Is that the theory on which you blew those programs? Not you, on which?
No, I wouldn't. I have no idea what Norwegian law is, but I do know that, for instance, in the Netherlands, there are serious inquiries going on. And there have been, and in many countries, in Brazil as well. I mean, the Petrobras spying is one, probably the best example. So, you know, without opining on the legality of these programs in these countries, certainly I believe broadly that the citizens of these countries and their ministers, one of the internal, one of the documents that we revealed recently was that, indicated that many of the government ministers in these countries aren't even aware of their, spying, clandestine services cooperation with NSA. So, you know, again, broadly speaking, without getting into the specifics of each individual disclosure, I do think it's important for the world to know these things.
So are you all going to be doing as much reporting on Russian intelligence practices, Chinese intelligence practices, French, German? I mean, you're not an American organization, right? It's, I take it, First Look is, you know, I don't know what it is, but I'm assuming it's not American. And so, you know, hopefully you're equal opportunity reporters.
Well, we are an American. I mean, right now we have an interesting roster because Glenn, of course, is based in Brazil. Laura Poitras has been living in Berlin. But we have an office here in New York, or we're getting one, I should say. And, you know, I think that those are calls that'll be made by the journalists, by Glenn and the others that are more involved in that. And I defer to their judgment on that. It's not my area. It's not my position to make those calls of newsworthiness, but I really trust the people that are doing it. We have a really great team making these decisions. And you can look at the reporting for the Washington Post, New York Times. Laura Poitras just published an article with Charlie Savage in the New York Times. So, you know, this is something that I think is going to be a focus for the media at large.
But, it does seem if your focus is going to end up being on U.S. intelligence practices, that people may eventually conclude, you know, this is an anti-American organization in the sense that it just wants to make revelations about the U.S. and these claims about being interested in transparency and democracy and preservation of the law and things like that are going to ring hollow and less true for people if there's not equal reporting on you know, far more aggressive practices in some countries and clearly illegal practices in other places.
Sure. You know, I think there's a lot to go in the life of these stories, and there's a lot of editorial and legal judgments that are going to need to be made. And those are, again, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to speculate on it because I have no more insight than you do, Michael, on that. But, you know, I think that Americans are really eager to learn about this information. Maybe not at the UCLA law campus, but I think the most recent polling indicates that a majority of Americans now oppose these programs. I'm referring to a USA Today Pew poll that came out late in February. And 3-1 Americans are saying that they do not believe they should sacrifice privacy for security. So, you know, the tide is, and by the way, this is in light of like almost a year of revelations, many of them about foreign countries. So I think Americans are broadly actually coming around to Mr. Snowden's side.
Dan, I wanted to just see if I understood the principle you announced, which was sort of, some countries, some of the ministers don't know about this. The people in those countries don't know that these programs are being carried out. On that basis, I mean, since intelligence is ordinarily carried out in secret, is there anything that you can't justify publishing?
Is there anything I can't justify publishing? Well, sure. I think that
on the basis that you know, the people in that country didn't know what was going on. The Taliban didn't know that they were being spied on. Actually, that is a program that Greenwald exposed, if I remember right.
Well, one thing that I think gets lost in this discussion a lot is the idea that who are we revealing this to? Who knows something now that they didn't know before? And I think that it's obvious to me personally that Al-Qaeda and their affiliates do know that they're being spied on. Osama bin Laden was not using computers, as far as I understand. It was all couriers passing encrypted drives and that things of that nature. So the terrorists know that we're looking for them. Certainly, our adversaries know that we're trying to look into what they're doing. But oh, but that's that
bogus. I'm sorry. Dan, that's just bogus. They know we're looking for them. They didn't know we were serving particular viruses, that we were using their Windows reports of crashes to figure out what exploits would work on their computers. They've learned a whole lot more about how to avoid U.S. scrutiny from your stories than they knew before. That you really can't use that justification.
Well, I do stand by that justification. I don't think that it's just simply I could turn that back and ask you how they don't know. These are the most sophisticated intelligence services in the world. They have hackers.
The Taliban? The Taliban?
Not the Taliban. You were speaking of the Russians and the Chinese. So, you know, my assumption, and I think it's a fair one, is that if the U.S. is able to do these things, the Internet is shared. So I don't see why the most sophisticated countries in the world aren't also able to do these things. So the people that really don't know this are the ordinary citizens. And the Windows exploit you mentioned is one of the, I believe you're referring to one of our recent articles, and we're talking about, they're talking about ramping up capability to affect millions of computers. Now, as far as I'm aware, there's not millions of members of Al-Qaeda that we're looking at. So these are things that affect ordinary people worldwide. So I think that there is a privacy interest. And I'm not convinced that this doesn't affect Americans.
Yeah, I can't think of anything you couldn't expose on that theory.
I think there's a lot of things that are appropriately not exposed. I don't think anyone's looking to make exposures that can harm human life. Certainly I wouldn't agree with that. And I don't think we're looking to expose the particular ways that we're targeting terrorists. There's many, many more capabilities, I'm sure, that are not going to be in the public view or ever make it in there, and that's appropriately so. So I do disagree with that. There are certainly limitations that I respect.
But is that the same? Can the same be said for other people at first look? I mean, even if you're not doing the same reporting as they are, there must be editorial meetings, and you know, at least for the New York Times and the Washington Post, you'll read that they withheld the story they delayed it for a matter of weeks until they got assurances that revelation wasn't going to interfere with a national security investigation or operation, or they'll leave out certain details. And they'll say that freely, that they're leaving out certain details at the request of the U.S. government. Does First Look or does The Intercept have any similar sort of policy?
Well, again, I can only refer you to what's been said publicly time and again, which is that these stories follow the same reporting processes as any other. They're vigorously fact-checked. The U.S. government is asked if there's a compelling reason, you know, give us one, and we'll withhold. And I think Glenn cited that he could only, he thought that maybe 99% of examples, there was no compelling reason cited, so they went ahead with the story. And I think what we're seeing now is that the U.S. government doesn't give compelling reasons. They don't feel that they have to. And now that there's been pushback, we're seeing important information come out. And I applaud the journalism that the Washington Post is doing, the New York Times is doing on this topic too. And I think that if you ask them, it'd be very few cases of things where they were given a compelling reason. That's just my speculation.
Dan, what does a legal analyst do at The Intercept?
That's a good question. My goal at The Intercept is to take these tricky legal topics that are oftentimes very difficult for the average person, a lay person, to understand and break them down and make them explainable to our readers. So, for instance, you know, when areas typically get into statutory interpretation or things like that, my goal is to talk to experts like yourselves and get a good take on it, provide my own insight, and explain to our readers really how the law is being used and to what ends.
And what stories have you written already?
I have one story out so far. It's about the Solicitor General's office, and it involves candor to the Supreme Court. There are several on the way. We're working really hard to build up our organization, so we actually just got our editor-in-chief, Mr. John Cook, formerly of Gawker Media. So we're looking to hit the ground running and start increasing the pace when it's feasible.
Tell us about your story now, because this is a really interesting story and issue. And this is about the 702 program, right? And
yes.
And the Clapper case, and it combines issues about standing and criminal cases. If you just give us a synopsis, and we can talk about
that's
that.
That's right. So this is something that actually that the Snowden reporting has shed a lot of light on, but actually really doesn't have much to do with it at all. The ACLU had challenged the 702 program, data collection program, as being unconstitutionally overbroad and indiscriminately sweeping up communications, domestic communications. The suit was brought on behalf of a group of attorneys, activists, all different. It's a very varied group, but basically the common thread among them was that they had regular dealings with people that were probably either suspects of terrorism or likely to be. And therefore, their belief was that they were very likely falling under the dragnet of surveillance. So they challenged the program. This was a program that was authorized in 2008 as part of the FISA Amendments Act, Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And as the case made its way through the courts and finally the Supreme Court, the U.S. government advanced the defense that the plaintiffs lacked standing, meaning that they did not have the grounds to challenge the suit because they were not, sorry, the law, because they were not personally affected by it. Now, the irony in this is that we now know because of Snowden that they almost certainly were caught in this, in the surveillance. But at the time, they had only, the law itself and some reporting on the law. On spying that had, come out earlier. So, the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli's, one of his central planks of his argument was that the plaintiffs were not the correct people to bring the case because there really was an ideal plaintiff lurking out there that just hadn't come forward yet. That plaintiff would be a criminal defendant. Criminal defendant meaning an accused terrorist that had been caught using these methods and brought to trial and then could therefore be in a position to challenge it saying, well, you never would have found me if not for this unconstitutional surveillance, and I want to have my day in court to challenge the surveillance program. Now, what the underpinning of that argument was that under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, there was a notice provision saying that if the government used any information obtained or derived from this surveillance against you in court, that you had a right to know about it, pretrial notice. And in his brief and later at oral argument, the Solicitor General stated that as a reasoning behind, as a rationale for why criminal defendants would be the correct person to have standing to challenge the law. And in the 5-4 decision authored by Justice Alito, that was cited as one of the rationales. Now, I can't say it was dispositive, but it certainly was an important rationale. And I think that the Solicitor General's reading of the law was correct in this instance. Now, as it turned out, they were not providing notice. In the 4-plus years that the program had been active, nobody had been given notice that the surveillance had been used against them. So this sort of came to a head because in December of 2012, Dianne Feinstein, who we discussed earlier, made a number of statements indicating that this program had been a big success and had caught many terrorists. So it was hard to reconcile her public statements with the judicial record stating that there was a notice provision that people would get notice. So according to the New York Times reporting on this topic, the Solicitor General was troubled by this, went back to the DOJ and said, what's the explanation for this? And it turned out they confirmed that they had not been providing notice. And then after a review was initiated, they reversed course. And late last year, they finally started providing notice. That's it in a nutshell. But there's some very difficult questions about when the DOJ knew this and who was responsible for vetting these statements. And we don't know, for instance, whether or not before the decision came down, whether or not the Solicitor General had determined that they weren't providing notice and whether or not the record was allowed to stand on an inaccuracy.
I assume there's some argument why they weren't providing notice. They may have concluded that they were not obliged, and then the Solicitor General may have changed people's mind about whether they were obliged or not. Do you know what the legal argument was for not providing it?
Yes. So that's essentially their argument in a nutshell. We don't really know, though, for instance, how they came to that conclusion that they weren't obliged to provide notice. All we know is that in a case for an individual named Muhammad Osmar Muhammad out in Oregon, they provided this supplemental notice to him saying, as it turns out, we've made the determination that you are entitled to this notice, and here it is. Here's your supplemental notice. Of course, he'd already been convicted, but that was the first sort of public reckoning with this.
Didn't they explain what their former rationale was?
They said that they had not previously considered whether or not information that was captured under the surveillance methods of 702, and then subsequently followed up using different electronic surveillance, was quote-unquote derived from the initial surveillance. So they said they just merely hadn't considered it. Now, we don't know whether or not they had a memo that they were consulting for this. This was universal. This wasn't merely prosecutors in Oregon making that decision. This was there's numerous cases where notice was not provided. So allegedly, the policy changed and that there's a new policy to provide notice. We haven't seen the new policy either. And a group of three U.S. senators have called upon the Solicitor General's office to provide more information. We're waiting to hear how this evolved and how the Justice Department's understanding of the topic evolved. But
you can imagine that their reading of this of the law was, if you have an independent basis for prosecuting this guy, such that you didn't actually need anything in the 702 interception to pursue the case, it's not derived from the case, from the interception. That's a plausible reading of the statute, isn't it?
And that was the prior practice, certainly outside of the 702 area. I mean, I have experience with this, I'm sure, and I did it at the Justice Department. That the intelligence community could turn over tips and leads and, you know, say, look, you may want to get a wiretap order on this number or a pen trap order to see whom he's calling because this is a suspicious number. And then if the Justice Department had its own wiretap and that produced evidence that could be used in a criminal trial, they would use that. And they would never turn over to the defense any information about how they first came to focus on that person. I mean, this is pure speculation, but my sense is that they probably just, despite the notice provision in 702, they probably just continued with that prior practice without thinking about or concluding that the notice provision in 702 didn't require a change in that practice. And obviously someone at Justice, and I got to imagine OLC was involved in this determination, someone said, no, this notice provision applies more broadly, and it says not just information from, based on what you said. I haven't looked at it recently, but it basically says any information derived from. And if you get a lead derived from the 702 program, I could see OLC or the SG concluding, you know, that really means anything that stems from the 702 collection, even if the evidence itself is gathered independently.
There's two issues that are really, I find, not very plausible. Number one, they said they never considered it. That strikes me as not realistic.
It does seem strange.
Because certainly when the Solicitor General read the statute, and by the way, all the statements were vetted by the Department of Justice. We don't know who vetted them. That's another question that's still open. He came to the same conclusion. This is an obvious, you know, it's an obvious call. It's derived from that surveillance. Now, I understand Stewart's argument to be about parallel construction, about taking a different chain of data of surveillance and sticking with that, and in which case the first one's sort of irrelevant and you don't have to present that in court. That's not what's at issue here. What's at issue here is from what we understand, although again it's still very murky, these individuals like Muhammad, other cases, were found, according to Senator Feinstein, within this program, and then they followed up. And what sort of provides the icing on the cake here is that when they were using traditional FISA surveillance, by traditional I mean obtaining a warrant for electronic surveillance of an individual, then following up with finding something, and then following up with a second form of surveillance, they were calling that derived, and they were giving notice. But if they took it one step further back and went to this 702 surveillance, that somehow the chain was broken, and it was not giving notice. So it wasn't even consistent with their own internal application of obtained or derived. Merely adding another layer of electronic surveillance for them was a question they could never have plausibly considered under their explanation.
The strangest part to me is what you alluded to earlier, and that is that that nobody in the Justice Department, in the Criminal Division or the National Security Division, said, "Wait a second, you can't make that argument because it's factually not true." Because you know that when the SG's office was preparing the briefs, and probably when they were preparing for oral argument, you know, they consulted with those divisions and said, is there anything along these lines that we should not be saying? You know, is it true that notice is being given or will be given? And someone clearly must have told them, you know, no, you can say that statement.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was confused about what the Solicitor General was saying in his briefs and oral argument. He was asked point blank by Justice Sotomayor, does somebody have standing? And he said, yeah, the criminal defendant has standing. The law says they have to get it. They have to get the notice. So I think that they were, you know, we hear a lot of phrases like least untrue or too clever by half. I think that they had a very tenuous interpretation, and they didn't want to, again, this is pre-Snowden, so we didn't know about the extent of these programs. I think that the impetus was they want to keep these things under wraps to the extent they can. They may believe that by the letter of what they were saying was true, but the spirit of it was well understood by the courts and by observers, and it just simply didn't, it doesn't add up now that there's been more scrutiny.
So are you going to keep digging into this to try to?
I am. The Solicitor General was asked for more information by Senators Wyden, Udall, and Heinrich. My understanding is that the Justice Department responded to their inquiry. We haven't seen the response yet, but I'm told it's forthcoming from the senators, so I will be following up, and I'd like to know more. There's a lot of interesting questions about timing-wise. When did the Solicitor General know? Was it before or after the Supreme Court ruled? And how did they come to the conclusion that this was not, they were not doing things right? When did they make the decision to change course? And I'd like to see the new policy, because we've had a scattering of notices given, but we have no idea what the universe of potential suspects is.
All right. Well, we are now setting a record for the longest podcast in the history of the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast. It is our fault. We spent too much time enjoying the news of the week and abusing poor Sophie Intervelt. But thanks, Dan, for coming on the program. Next, we expect Glenn Greenwald. This has been, if not Edward Snowden, this has been episode 11 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vattis, Markham Erickson, Daniela Taruso, and Dan Novak for their participation. And we hope you'll all join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. For more information, please visit our website at www.steptoecyberblog.com.